We're back with a new season thanks to Harvest. They make my favorite business software. Yeah, the one I use to get paid. From invoicing to project planning to time tracking, Harvest is the tool for freelancers, agencies, consultants, and anyone who wants to keep their projects and payments running smoothly. Try it free at getharvest.com/strongfeelings, and that URL is going to get you 50% off your first paid month. That's getharvest.com/strongfeelings.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who I am.
Hey everyone, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Gatel.
And this is Strong Feelings, a podcast about work, friendship, and feminism, and what happens when you bring them all together.
Okay, so today, for the very first time, we are welcoming a guest back to Strong Feelings. Mary Pfeiffer first joined us in the spring to talk about women and aging and ended up making us think differently about ourselves and our friendships. Today, she's joining us again, this time with her daughter, educator and writer Sarah Pfeiffer Gilliam. And together, they co-wrote a 25th anniversary edition of Mary's best-selling 1994 book, Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls. It just came out last month, and it got us thinking a lot about our adolescent selves.
I wish we'd known each other as teens. Do you think we'd have been friends?
I absolutely think we would have been friends. I was just thinking about that photo you posted a while back on Instagram. It was definitely from the mid-90s, which is when I was, albeit graduating high school, but I feel like I would have wanted to have been friends with that girl in the photo.
Wait, do you mean the school picture I posted that I found at my mom's house, like a framed 8x10?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I was wearing a like flower print baby doll dress. And how many necklaces?
I think there's at least
two necklaces.
So good.
That was the eighth grade, 1986, eighth grade. So I think you definitely would not have been friends with me because I would have been in middle school. But I would have made you a dope hemp necklace.
I mean, that would have gone really well with my Baja hoodie I wore all the time.
Gosh, the real question is, how many of your pants came from Goodwill?
Oh, all of them.
Only from the old man corduroy section.
Absolutely.
Okay, so one of the things that Sarah and Mary talk about in this interview is the differences between adolescence in the U.S. today versus in the 1990s when Mary first wrote her book. And one of the shifts that comes up is that teens today apparently don't go out with their friends as much and don't go do things alone as much. And way fewer of them are doing things like getting part-time jobs or getting driver's licenses. And that's something that I found really hard to relate to. You know, I was so eager for those kinds of markers of adulthood. I mean, Sarah Gilliam in the interview, she talks about this. She talks about how she was camped out at the DMV on her 16th birthday.
Oh, I was absolutely at the DMV on my birthday. I barely passed the test, but I did it. And I was just elated. I remember that feeling. And the first car I drove was an old used Nissan Sentra we got for $400. And it was a manual that only went to fourth gear.
So that's how many gears I thought was normal at the time.
No, it was definitely five gears. I mean, at least that was the first time I'd seen one that was only
No. That was pretty typical for old shitty cars.
I guess so. And it was just it didn't go very fast, which is smart on my mom's part because she was sort of hey, you can only go this fast. But it was really great because all of a sudden I had this very real freedom.
Yeah, I remember I definitely got my learner's permit the day I was eligible. But that for some reason, I remember when I turned 16, I couldn't get my driver's license for 2 weeks after my birthday. And I can't remember why there was I couldn't get an appointment at the DMV or because of the timing, I couldn't get anybody to take me or whatever it was. It was 2 weeks afterwards. And I remember it being this excruciating long period of time where I was I can't believe it's 2 weeks after my birthday and I still don't have a license. How embarrassing.
You're oh.
I was so frustrated. I had to wait that long. And, I think I felt like that about a lot of things as a teen. I was when do I get to move out? When am I going to have my, own cell phone? When am I going to have a job? When am I going to go to college parties? I would go to shows by myself starting at age 16 pretty regularly. I was very much how can I be capital I independent in as many ways as possible? And I guess that was just such a core part of what my teen experience was like. It's hard for me to imagine something else.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I remember being that age and I feel like I just couldn't, get out of high school fast enough. I couldn't move towards, quote unquote, adult things fast enough. And I think a big part of that was having a bunch of older friends. When I was a sophomore in high school, my friends were, all seniors or graduating and starting jobs or going to state college. And I saw them doing all these grown-up things going to college parties and concerts concerts or dance clubs and like getting in. But I also saw them getting apartments or, you know, buying their first car. And I had a lot of freedom as a teenager. So I think the adult stuff kind of just felt more like doing it on my own and like maybe not coming home to a room I slept in my mom's house.
Yeah. Well, so interestingly, speaking of a room you slept in your mom's house, you didn't move out though, right?
No, not till I was like 25. And I mean, mostly that was because I did, you know, I didn't go to a university, so I didn't like move off to college. And I, you know, I could have or should have probably gotten my own place, but I didn't have a lot of money. And a lot of my friends, like I said, had apartments. So I just spent a lot of time there.
I don't think I would have been able to handle it. I moved out, I think, the week of my high school graduation. My brother was gone for the summer that year. And so I was subletting his place. And so I moved in with this truly massive University of Oregon track team hammer thrower.
Oh, sure.
Adam was a sweetheart. He wasn't a great roommate, but he was a sweetheart. I mean, to be fair, I also probably wasn't a great roommate, but I think my rent that summer was only like $285. I can't remember exactly. The cost of living was pretty low in Eugene back then. I remember I did have to pay $450 a month when I had my own apartment, and it was a stretch. It was really hard. I mean, I was also, I was on food stamps and I was working as many hours as I could while I was in school. And I had scholarships, which was a big part of it. But for me, you know, like I remember that $450 a month payment being like, wow, how are we going to do that? And so I can understand the money saving of staying at home. But I guess I was always so committed to independence that I was like, whatever it takes, including like however many hours I got to work, I will work that many hours.
Yeah, totally. Well, OK, so what was your first, you know, proper job, like one that you had to fill out a W-4 before the first day?
Yeah, so that was in high school. I worked at a gym. I had actually started out doing like childcare and cleaning for the gym, and then I got promoted to front desk, which was pretty exciting. Mm. Before that, I'd done things like babysitting, and I'd done some work for like my dad's small business, but the gym job was like my first real job, and I think that was right at the end of my junior year of high school. Mm-hmm. What was yours? What was your first real one?
First real job where I got like a paycheck was at a plant nursery, and it was the year before I started driving because I was kind of like, all right, I'm going to need gas money or, you know, going to start driving and doing things. It was at a plant nursery. I think I definitely got paid mostly in cash, which was kind of shady. Oof,
I'm not sure that was a real job.
You know, who knows? But then I got a job at a medical park near the local hospital as a receptionist in a physical therapy office. And that was like an official job. I had to wear khakis and a polo shirt and a name tag.
Yes, I had that exact same uniform at the gym, right? Yeah. Khakis, polo, name tag. So professional.
Yeah, totally.
Gosh, it's funny. I think part of the reason it was hard to get a job earlier where I lived is that you absolutely needed to have a car, or you'd have parents who would like drop you off at work, which was definitely not a family that I had. Like you just couldn't get anywhere if you didn't drive, which I think it just depends so much on like where you live in this country. But yeah, I think for me, a big part of it was as soon as I, you know, was able to drive myself around, I was like, okay, now I can handle this.
Yeah. And I actually loved going somewhere and doing something that was, you know, sort of a routine, and it was a different kind of accountability than reporting to teachers and, you know, having to do homework. And I just, you know, and I, like you, I liked having some money that was my own to do with what I wanted.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that you like going and having a routine, because I mean, I hated my shitty jobs on one level, right? Like nobody likes those jobs.
For sure.
I definitely cleaned some really gross things out of like locker rooms. Didn't love it. But there was something about being responsible and like having a shift that was mine. Mm. Unlike school, which is like a thing that you had to go to that like you had never really chosen, this was something that like I had tried to get this job. I had then been offered the job. And so, you know, this was mine. And it made me feel kind of like, oh, you're a real person in the world, you know? And I think looking back, even in all of those crappy jobs I had, because I had a series of them, I was always really eager to take on new responsibility. I was always like taking on more hours. And some of it was definitely financial. Like we did not have money. I was a teenager who wanted things. I wanted to be able to buy clothes or CDs or whatever.
Ugh, yeah.
And I also wanted sort of the status of having things, right?
Sure.
Because you fit in because you have CDs or clothes or whatever. And I had to buy things like clove cigarettes, very important expense.
Obviously.
Oh, so gross. Please don't smoke clove cigarettes. And then I also, though, I had really important expenses, to be honest. I mean, I was using my paychecks to pay for things like the SATs and college application fees. Like, did I tell you I scored outrageously high on the SATs?
Oh my God, I'm like, not surprised.
Very, very, very high. And I had a perfect GPA that I protected so carefully.
Yeah, you got to.
I only applied to one school because it was like $75 per school to apply. And I was like, that's like 15 hours of work. I can't afford to do this over and over again.
Yeah. Oh my God. I feel that so much. I did not do great on the SATs.
That's okay. They don't actually mean anything. Let me be clear. I just happened to be very good at them.
I mean, that's good that I know that now, but like I'm very actually proud of you in retrospect. I think that is a big accomplishment. But I did take AP tests and I placed out of a couple 101 classes for college, but I wasn't even as proud of the like placement as I was that I wouldn't have to pay for those courses when I got to college. And I also only applied to one school for that same reason.
Recently, I've been thinking a little bit more about this period of my life, and I was actually talking about some of this with my therapist. And something that I realize now is that I also had this very deep sense of there not really being space for me at home to need things, and that sort of transcended financial reasons. Yeah. It was really like my parents were splitting up in this very dramatic way when I was in high school. We had very little money, and I think I decided that the best thing that I could do was sort of need as little as possible, right? Like, don't need things. Assume that Sarah's taken care of because she'll figure it out. Don't worry about me. Yeah. And I think even further than that, like if I go all the way back to middle school, I had this really, really traumatic thing happen in middle school where I was bullied incessantly for years because of a truth or dare game gone awry at a Christian camp. You can fill in the blanks. It wasn't good. So I remember finally telling my parents about it and my dad going down to the school to like demand that they do something about it. And that just made it worse.
Yeah, of course.
And then he came home and I got screamed at and grounded because I had, quote unquote, lied to him because I hadn't told him about it originally. And it was like, you know, you're not grounded. You're like, he was like, you're grounded for lying.
Oh, God.
And of course, it's so sad to me now to think about that because it's like, yeah, I wasn't honest about what was going on because I felt so ashamed of everything and because it was so like hard to talk about. And the fact that he couldn't see that and he made it all about himself. And like, anyway, for many, many reasons, I feel like I had learned by this point just to not express needs, right? Like pay your own way, figure it out for yourself, just always be fine at all costs because help isn't coming. And if it comes, it's not help anyway.
Right. Oh, God, Sarah, that is a lot to carry. And I definitely see how that shaped things for you.
I do tend to be somewhat independent and sometimes maybe not to my own benefit. Like part of me sees these studies about how teens today are different than that, are less likely to want to push for independence. And I think, you know, well, gosh, independence is really good. Going and getting jobs is good. You need to figure out how to handle things like having your own responsibilities and bills and finances. You need to learn how to make decisions on your own, et cetera. And I think that that's true, but then it's also like being at the extreme end of that is not great.
Mm-hmm, totally.
And there are some really big costs to my feelings about needing independence. Like, obviously, there's the piece where I just felt really alone about a lot of things, but there is also all of these ways I was playing adult that were not totally safe, right? Like, I would go with my kind of bad girlfriends to some very sketchy parties. I started quote-unquote dating this way older guy, and that was a really bad scene that was not healthy, and I was definitely not going to tell anybody about it. Who could have told me otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, half of me doesn't know how I'd handle that if I had kids. Like,
oof.
Yeah, like figuring out how to, you know, try to protect them or spare them from risky stuff. But then I also think like, hell, I did a lot of risky ass shit, like, you know, trying drugs and always breaking curfew and having sex pretty early. And I'm okay? Question mark. But I did get into some trouble. Like, I did. Could I have made, you know, really stupid decisions and gotten into even more trouble? Yeah, probably. But I do also think that a lot of kids and young people are not treated with enough trust and respect.
Yeah. So I think it's hard. There's never really going to be a perfect balance, right? Because every kid is different. And also the world doesn't always work out like you think, right? So sometimes bad shit just happens. Sometimes you do risky stuff, but you turn out fine. Yeah. Sometimes that stuff can be really traumatic and stick with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so many different ways things can go. But I do think for me, it would have helped me a lot to have more trust and respect. And I think that particularly with my dad, because, you know, what I ended up having was a fair bit of fear because I felt like I couldn't talk about things that were actually happening because then I might get in trouble. And so I had definitely learned to be secretive. And not only was I secretive, I also was pretty against listening to adult advice by this point. And I think that, like, a lot of teens are against listening to adult advice.
Yeah.
I get that that's pretty normal. But I think part of it was that I didn't really feel like anyone was listening to me or understood me. And so, like, why listen to them, right? And so that was, again, just leading me down this path of figuring it all out alone. And that was not always a good path.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, none of this is totally clear or easy. And this interview with Mary and Sarah really helped me think about how it all continues to, you know, play out in adulthood. Like, we're sitting here talking about all of this. And there are so many things that change, but also stay the same with each new generation that comes along.
And, you know, I think it really gave me some good insight into what teens today are dealing with, because I had kind of assumed it was pretty much the sort of thing that I was dealing with. I hadn't really thought enough about how they might be different. And so that was so valuable to me. And I feel like I learned a ton. Today, we're talking with Mary Pfeiffer, who you might remember from episode 56 back in April when we talked about women and aging. We loved talking with Mary so much, we knew we needed to have her back, and this time to talk about a very different age group, adolescent girls. And we're also joined by someone extra special, which is Mary's daughter. Sarah Pfeiffer Gilliam is an educator and a writer, and together they co-wrote a brand new 25th anniversary edition of Mary's landmark book, Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Selves of Adolescent Girls. So Sarah, welcome to Strong Feelings, and Mary, welcome back. We're so excited to talk with you both today.
Thank you very much.
Well, so first up, for those listeners who aren't familiar with Reviving Ophelia, Mary, can you tell us a little bit about the original project? What led you to write the book and what went into it?
Well, I published Reviving Ophelia in 1994, and I was a therapist in private practice in Lincoln, Nebraska. My office was filled with teenage girls in trouble. They were in trouble because of conflict with parents, trouble at school with grades and teachers, refusing to go to school, and then many at-risk behaviors. Girls were drinking, staying out late at night, involved with early sexual behavior, a lot of pregnancy, a lot of STDs. So parents were bringing in girls who were angry, in conflict with them, lots of times had been in trouble of some kind with the law or had a car wreck or were pregnant. And nobody really knew what was going on or how to deal with those girls. The current theory at that time was the dysfunctional model or family model, which was basically if a girl was in trouble, it's because something was wrong in the family, especially with her mother, her parents. But girls were particularly angry at their mothers because mothers were supposed to be the people that kept them safe and emotionally grounded. And when they didn't feel that way, somehow it ended up being their mom's fault. So what I felt when I was doing therapy with these girls is, first of all, a lot of these girls that I was seeing were the brightest and the best. They were smart, they were mature, but they were in trouble, not at home, but they started having trouble when they hit the big middle schools here in town and encountered sexual harassment and bullying. And at that time, too, the electronic culture, the TV, MTV, was really, really a part of teenagers' lives in a way it had never been before. And neither girls nor their parents quite understood the implication of that. So when I wrote Reviving Ophelia, what I really wanted to say is the girls I'm seeing in therapy are not in trouble because of dysfunctional families. In fact, their parents are really trying hard to save them, but they don't quite know how. They're in trouble because of the really misanthropic girl poisoning culture they're being raised in. And if we want to make girls happier, if we want to make them better adjusted and help them deal with their at-risk behaviors, we need to change the culture. So that book was a paradigm shift. And after it was written, things got better. Now, I'm not saying, oh, because I wrote a book, the culture got better. But it was part of an education project for the country on the fact that the cultural streets for girls in 94 were very mean streets. And that my generation of parents had not had much experience dealing with that kind of a situation, and we weren't ready for it. We didn't realize that girls were getting two kind of education, one in the home and from their teachers and their churches and families and grandparents and so on, and a very different one from the movies and television and music they were listening to. And neither girls nor their parents understood how to reconcile that gap.
at the time, Sarah, you were a teen girl when the book came out, right? So how was that for you to have your mom being, you know, so engaged in a project like this and talking about all of these issues that were actually the things that you and your friends were facing?
Yeah. So by and large, it was a positive experience. Several of my friends were interviewed for the book and I got to kind of go through and edit it for teen language. You know, is this something a teenager would say, that kind of thing? You know, I was seeing in my peers and my friends the things that my mom was writing about in the book. And so in that sense, it very much rang true to me. Now, maybe I would have said, oh, come on, Mom, I love Madonna. I don't mind her provocative outfits, something like that. But in terms of the larger cultural messages and the challenges that girls were facing in the early 90s, my mom and I were very simpatico in terms of what we felt the issues were. And I will also say that the book came out right before I graduated from high school. So it really became this force. You know, it spent several years on the New York Times bestseller list, and my mom was doing a lot of speaking and a lot of television. That all kind of happened while I was finding my footing in college. And so I missed a lot of the kind of, you know, cultural fallout, I guess, that came from Reviving Ophelia. But it was really exciting. And I was really proud of my mom and I was proud of the book. And then I'd get to college and we'd be reading it in a women's studies class.
Gosh, that must have been kind of amazing. Now, back then, could you ever have imagined working with your mom?
No. We had a very typical mother-daughter relationship. And I actually always did want to be a writer. I was sort of tracking myself education-wise and all of that to be a writer. But it didn't occur to me at that time how much our culture could change across 25 years, to be honest. I mean, it would never occur to me that there would need to be a fairly epic re-envisioning and rewrite of Reviving to make it relevant for a new generation. So I would say that our careers kind of moved along parallel to each other. I've always been really inspired by her as a writer. She and I are each other's first editors for everything that we write. We love reading each other's work, but the actual idea to work together was really kind of a pleasant surprise.
So Mary, let's fast forward to the new version. What mm-hmm. led you to want to revise that book, and, you know, why now?
The idea to republish Reviving Ophelia, 25th year edition, was Sarah's. And she had the idea in the shower and then emailed me. I thought it would be just a sort of a commemoration edition. But as Sarah and I both read the book, we realized the world has changed enormously. And I mean, just for example, just a few things. Since 94, we had Columbine. We had 9/11 and Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We've had much more global climate change. We've had a much more awareness of the ecological crisis. And we've had very different financial situation. People are, in general, struggling much more with money, especially college-age students are right now. And the polarization of the country, that's grown much worse since 94. And then on top of that, of course, digital media. So as we looked at all the changes, we realized we couldn't just republish Reviving Ophelia. We had to rewrite it. So we took out 30,000 words and we put back in 30,000 words and did a whole research project and rewrite of the entire book. It was a much bigger project than we'd signed on for. But ultimately, both Sarah and I wanted to make this new book relevant and as useful to 2019 girls as Reviving was to 1994 girls.
Yeah, I'm curious about the process a little bit. You mentioned you did a lot of new research. How did that change the sort of data and stories you heard from, you know, from the first edition?
The first edition was primarily written around therapy clients. And I did some interviews with high school age girls and some focus groups. I interviewed, as Sarah said, some of her friends and some of the daughters of my friends. And talked to a lot of mothers because I had many friends who had teenage girls at that time. But this book was not therapy clients. I talked to therapists. Sarah talked to educators. She's been a middle school teacher. And then we both talked to girls. But primarily the way we researched this book involved ordinary girls who were not in therapy.
So the first thing that we did that was really fun is we sent actual copies of the original paperback book to girls around the country. I sort of cast a net to people I knew around the country and said, hey, do you know a really sharp adolescent girl that would like a project? And so we asked the girls to mark up the book. X out sections, say this doesn't feel relevant, this doesn't ring true to me anymore. And then likewise, write in margin notes and tell us what's missing and what you'd like to see in a new edition. And that really informed where we went right off the bat in terms of what themes and topics emerged right away. And then we had focus groups with middle school girls and high school girls. We separated them by age because, of course, you're going to talk about really different things with girls in those two different age groups. And then we did a lot of individual interviews. So it was challenging, as Mary said, if she was following a girl through the therapeutic relationship across 2 years, she could tell a very rich and deep story of that girl's progress and transformation. Whereas we were doing interviews with individual girls for this book that lasted an hour or two. But so what was important to us was to take, for example, a theme in the book, like the mother-daughter relationship, and find a girl and a story that was the 2019 version of that, a very contemporary version of that for one reason or another. And then we also wanted to bring forth girls who wouldn't have been in the original book because the challenges that they're dealing with or the life experiences that they're having were really not on the cultural radar. And a very sort of straightforward example of that is that we have a transgender girl as kind of a strong girl profiled in the new edition of the book. Speaking for myself as a teenager in 1994, I had never heard the word transgender, and sort of gender fluidity and this entire new discourse that we're having around gender just wasn't on the radar 25 years ago.
So yeah, you mentioned that the first edition was mostly therapy clients, which means, you know, you had really rich stories, but it also means that the research was sort of limited to the girls you had, you know, met in practice. So girls from mostly one place and with parents who had access to a knowledge of therapy. Did the new research allow you to reach a wider range of girls, you know, racially, ethnically, geographically, even economically than the first edition?
Yes, and that was absolutely our goal. You know, it's not a discredit to the book, but like you said, my mom, for the most part, was working with kind of a self-selected group of girls because, for the most part, it meant their parents could pay for therapy. So most of the girls were middle class, and the book was written in the 90s in Lincoln, Nebraska, which was a fairly white middle-class town. So without a doubt, we wanted to broaden the lens of this book and look at the experience of girls of color, of immigrant and refugee girls, of girls who identify, you know, more broadly across the gender or sexuality spectrum, urban and rural girls. So we would do Skype interviews with girls in large cities, who of course bring a different perspective to what adolescence looks like in 2019 than a girl in a small town in Nebraska. So without a doubt, we really wanted to be reflective of who adolescent girls are in 2019. And of course, literally the face of our country has changed quite a bit in the last 25 years.
How did these interviews with, like you mentioned, trans girls or racially diverse girls shift things?
The transgender girl is a whole new topic. And so it didn't shift things as much as it sort of staked new territory in terms of this is what adolescence looks like today. And there's much more financial pressure now. So that was a topic that really, the 90s were the prosperous Clinton era, and money didn't come up as much. Money came up much more as a topic. And money, for example, was very related to the academic stress girls felt, because so many girls we talked to with this book were saying they really needed to make good grades and get into college on some kind of scholarship if they were going to be able to go to college. So there were some ways like that, that it was very different. But for the most part, the thing we really figured out writing this book was that the culture has changed a lot. Primarily, what's changed the culture the most is social media. Girls were getting happier and more well-adjusted after 94. 93 was a low point for depression and mental health. And then 94, the year Reviving Ophelia was published, was a year in which girls started to be happier and continued to be happier up till 2007. In 2007, all of the graphs that suggested happier, better adjusted girls reversed themselves and started to plummet. And 2007 was the year the iPhone was invented and started to be popular. So the big story that we ended up writing about in terms of changes in girls is the social media story. That is by far the biggest factor in what's affected the health of girls in 2019.
That's something that we wanted to ask a little bit about. It's obviously been a big shift in society at large. And one of the things that we noticed in this edition was that you talked a lot about how a lot of the stories in the first edition were about other kinds of problems, like you said, drugs, alcohol, teen pregnancy, you know, girls who are in unsafe relationships, having risky sexual encounters. And the problems you talked about in the newer interviews were much more related to, some directly related to social media, but a lot of other types of issues around like anxiety, higher prevalence of suicide. And I'm really curious if you could talk a little bit more about how that shift has happened. And I guess you talk about how one of the problems is girls sort of like losing their true selves and having these kind of false selves. And it seems like you're saying that it's the same kind of problems manifesting differently. So instead of manifesting as, you know, I don't know, 14-year-old going out and drinking, it might be manifesting as these highly anxious and depressed girls who are having all these problems with social media. And I wonder if we can just kind of dig into a little bit more about what that means.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, there are some kind of core jobs that the era of adolescence is supposed to do for girls and young women, right? Emotional maturation and perspective building, and it should help them become less narcissistic and more focused on the broader world. And social media and devices and screen time and all, you know, whatever language you want to use around that really works against those core tasks. And it really has effects on every aspect of girls' development, emotional, physical, social, sexual, maturational. All of these things are affected by this little smartphone that an adolescent girl is holding in her hand, typically for 9 hours a day. And so if we view the time that she is spending as building a self online, whether that's the personality that comes through in group texts with friends, to her profiles on social media sites, to the selfies that she posts, or the photos and stories she shares about her life, what we find is that doesn't particularly mirror the lives that girls are actually leading. And the girls in focus groups that we talked to all talked about really simple stuff, you know, and frankly, I think this may ring true for the two of you hosting this podcast. It rings true for me. I put a photo up, and if I don't get the reaction I'm hoping for, I take it down. I'm very dialed into how people respond to photos of myself that I put up. I get jealous if I see someone's life seems more exciting than the life that I'm leading. And so all of this effort is spent creating this online self. But unfortunately, from our perspective, that's happening at the diminishment of the creation of an authentic self. Because if I think back, and we're about the same age, to my adolescence, I was out with friends. I was laying in the park with friends late at night, talking about, you know, where we wanted to go to school, what we wanted to do with our life, our frustrations with our family or our peers. We were having those deep, rich, angst-filled adolescent conversations that are part of forming who we were. We were working part-time jobs. So we were meeting the whole gamut of personalities and types of people that existed in our community and learning how to deal with people different than ourselves. And when we take away those human interactions and girls instead are surfing Instagram and watching Netflix at home alone on Saturday nights, we're really doing them a huge disservice because we're not creating the space in which they're going to be forming their authentic selves. And then when they kind of head out into the real world, they aren't sure who they are. And even though they may have a South by Southwest panel this last year had a great topic that was 10,000 followers and no friends. And we have this generation of girls that may have a very vibrant online self, but not a particularly well-formed, you know, effective or whole real life self.
Yes. And there's two ways to build a sense of identity and a true self. One of them is by interacting with the world and seeing oneself in the reflected appraisals of other and processing one's experience with other people and getting feedback and so on. The other way to develop a true self is solitude and having time to be reflective. Well, if you're on a device 9 hours a day, the experience of solitude is almost non-existent. So there's a strange way in which girls today are never together and never alone. And so the primary building blocks of self, which is to be interacting face-to-face with other people and to be alone reflecting and developing one's own inner strength, those aren't occurring right now. The other thing is by going out and interacting in the real world with real problems, historically, girls have developed skills, confidence, and competencies. Now what tends to be happening is girls are sitting at home or sitting in a restaurant with their parents or riding around town with their mom or dad driving, looking at a cell phone. And they're living life online, but they're actually not out navigating the real world, meeting challenges and mastering things on their own. In fact, if they have a challenge in the world, their most likely response to it is to text their mom or dad and ask them how to handle it, or text their friends and say, what do you think I should do? Now, what that does is keep girls from learning that they can actually solve problems, develop skills, and so on their own, and it keeps them from developing skills. So that when they go to college, for example, they're utterly unprepared to face life on their own. And that's why, like, for example, when girls go to college now, they have historic levels of anxiety. And 62% of young women at this point are reporting overwhelming anxiety and panic when they're freshmen in college. So one of the things we recommend in this book, it is if you want to help girls develop to be strong and competent and confident, you actually need to nudge them toward experiences that induce stress and calibrate that stress so they have a reasonably good chance of succeeding most of the time. So, for example, a good way to start a process like this is to really encourage a girl to get a driver's license. That's a basic rite of passage. Another really good way to help a girl go out and deal with the real world is say, we want you to have either a volunteer or a real job where you're actually out just dealing with all kinds of people in a situation where you can't text or call home, where you have to actually solve everything that comes up as a problem on your own. Or we want you to be responsible for planning a dinner party for your friends and inviting 8 people over and planning the meal and cooking it. Or we want you to be responsible for planning our family vacation. Here's how much time we have. Here's how much money we have. Here's where we want to go. And we want you to figure out all this stuff and plan it. So those kind of things put girls in a position where they're outside their comfort zone. They're doing things that they're not used to doing, but yet as they do them, they feel more confident.
Gosh, it kind of makes me sad to think that this isn't happening that much now. I think back to all of the, you know, shitty jobs I had and dinner cooking responsibilities I had and amount of unstructured time I had running around with friends. And I think about bad things happen sometimes, but so much of that was really positive for me, even the really crappy jobs. it's a little sad to think of that not happening for girls right now.
That was a big surprise to me when we started and diving back into this rewrite. I had no idea that if you're looking at a graph of teenage girls acquiring their driver's licenses, it's a plummeting line. I mean, far fewer, and I don't know where you grew up, if you grew up in a city where you relied on public transportation, but I think I was at the DMV at 6 a.m. on my 16th birthday. And so were all my friends. And we also couldn't wait to get jobs, not just because we wanted money, but because we wanted every opportunity to be out of the house and asserting our independence and being young adults. And likewise, it was, you know, fate worse than death to be home on a Friday night or a Saturday night instead of out with your friends. And that's why grounding was such an effective consequence. Well, now the effective consequence is taking away screens and screen times or taking away a phone, because that's how girls are connecting with, quote unquote, the real world.
Gosh, that's so interesting. And yes, like you, I grew up in a place that was driving oriented, which meant that I was very, 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 very focused on my 16th birthday.
Exactly.
Extremely important. So something I wanted to come back around to, though, is this conversation about social media, because I feel like this is one thing that's really hard to contend with, because I think, you know, you can tell girls to like put their phones away, but that's a hard task in the culture that we're in. Mm-hmm. It's like hard to deal with, I think, on an individual level. And same for older women as well. You know, many, if not most of the professional women I know are also very tied into social media. Sarah, you mentioned that, you know, you post stuff and delete it and get concerned. And all of us can be susceptible to those like quick dopamine hits that come from external validation. Mm-hmm. But we do live in a world where, you know, so much of modern life is built around technology. It's very much baked into educational and professional systems. So if you're offline, it can be hard to do things like build a network that will get you an internship or build a reputation or promote the work that you're doing. And I guess one thing I'm trying to figure out is, if logging off doesn't feel like an option, how do we handle this personally? And then what do we do about it at more of a cultural level, right? Like what needs to change culturally in our relationship to technology that would enable more people to have that kind of healthy balance?
I mean, first of all, I completely agree with you. The train has left the station. Nowhere in this book are we telling girls, get rid of your smartphones. I mean, that's not a realistic conversation to try to have at this point. The best things that we can encourage are intentionality and thoughtfulness around, you know, social media and device usage at large. And what we found talking to these girls in focus groups, what's been most effective for them is that, well, first of all, let me just say that they can recognize their problems with social media. They aren't just singing its praises. They almost seem wistful for the days before this constant connectedness. But they will say in the same breath that they can't live without their phone or their tablet or whatnot. But the things that they had found kind of organically on their own that were most effective were actually agreements among friends. So interestingly, taking parents out of the equation for the moment and friends sitting down and saying, okay, I'm not going to look at my phone after 7 p.m. Like that's homework time or that's family time. Or like, let's all agree that Sundays we're not going to use our phones. Or during the school week, we're going to take certain apps off our phones because they're a distraction. And the girls empowering themselves, which is a real recurring theme in this new edition of Reviving Ophelia across a lot of fears of adolescent life, was actually the most effective path to kind of balancing use of social media. And so while we don't give any hard and fast recommendations, because this conversation looks different for every girl, every adult professional woman, every family. But the idea is don't be afraid to have that conversation, you know, and set some basic boundaries. All devices are going to charge in the kitchen overnight, or we're going to have meals and we're not going to check our phones. I mean, the problem is too, from my perspective, if we're always expected to be connected and say, you know, if you're thinking of your audience and professional women, if they feel that they always have to be accessible to colleagues or bosses, and they've always got to be online and they've always got to, you know, be posting so that they have a vibrant online presence, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that feeds itself. And so I think any ways in which we can turn the dial back a little bit and put these little pieces of intentionality into our thinking and our conversations about this, that's progress.
Yeah. What we're writing about is not, we know how to solve this problem. We're saying, much as I said in Reviving Ophelia, is here's a way to understand this problem. For example, one of the things we tried to do was look at the research on, for example, the way all the graphs toward improvement plummeted after 2007, and look at where girls are today in terms of all-time highs and depression and anxiety, and then compare that with social media use and say, here is the reason why this is happening. We can unpack for you why so much social media use causes these problems. And then what our hope is very similar to my hope when I wrote Reviving Ophelia, which is this is a good, important conversation that the adults in this country should be having. You know, if you don't develop as an adolescent, you don't become an adult. Adolescence is a core developmental stage toward being able to function as an adult in a culture. So it's too big of a situation to ignore. Now, those skills only come when we have a reasonably good process for helping teenagers grow into adults. Right now, we don't have that process, and we aren't going to have that process without some fairly serious rejiggering of how we do things in this culture. I could not write a book, or I could not work as a therapist, or for that matter, survive as a human being, if I didn't have hope, if I didn't believe that my own actions could make a difference. And in fact, one thing I feel great about is I think Reviving Ophelia did make a difference. I think a lot of things are going to happen in the next few years, including I think there's going to be some government regulation of social media platforms. And we're seeing teenagers want to control their media use and figuring out ways on their own to do that.
Yeah. So you mentioned something as you were talking about social media that I'd love to kind of come back around to, which is some of the challenges that come out of not building that healthy sense of self as an adolescent and sort of what that looks like in adults. And in the book, you talked about how you saw lots of adult women in your therapy practice who would come to you wanting to be more pleasing to others, like saying they wanted to lose weight, or they wanted to be less depressed, or they wanted to rescue their marriage. And that when you tried to ask them about their own needs, they would just be confused. And I think that's something a lot of our listeners will still relate to. And so you connected that back to them sort of struggling alone with the trauma of adolescence and not processing those adolescent experiences, not examining them. And I'm curious if we can talk a little bit more about that. Like, how does this loss of self in adolescence sort of keep coming back to haunt us as we grow older?
When I was writing in 94, I was talking about the loss of self in two ways with women. One is we were socialized at that time. We grew up with mothers and aunts and grandparents whose belief was that as women, their duty was to serve. And their responsibility was to make sure the emotional welfare of everyone in their life was happy and well cared for and safe. They were not taught to take care of themselves. I mean, I remember this very well as a little girl, that I was very much praised for being a good little girl, a good little helper, a good big sister. I was very much raised, as almost all girls were at the time, that the best thing I could be was a really good girl who took care of other people and always put my needs last. Well, that's very good advice in the sense I think it's good to raise children to be kind and to be good people. But nobody said you have a right to include yourself when you're talking about being good to people. You get to be good to you too. And that it's very important for you when you're deciding a calculation about how to be good to people to add yourself to that calculation and give yourself permission to also have a life that you're enjoying and to make choices that meet your needs and so on. So my generation of women had to learn that on their own. And that explained a certain lostness when we were in adults. And we were tasked with keeping our families happy. And not only were they not happy, but if a therapist like myself asked a woman in the early 90s, well, what do you need to be happy? A lot of times they had no idea because that was a new question to them. The other way that girls lost a sense of self was the way Simone de Beauvoir wrote about that lost sense of self, that up until they were 8 or 9, they could be who they wanted to be. And they could be people who were engaged in all of the wealth of life experiences available to 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds. But then when they hit puberty, all of a sudden, they crashed into this world where they were sexualized, objectified. There started to be all these expectations about how they behaved, and they were defined in ways by the culture that made it very difficult for them to be their true selves. So that's really what I was writing about in the 90s. Now, modern girls, I think, are much more comfortable taking care of themselves. Their mothers haven't raised them to be endlessly self-sacrificing. And I think that's great. I don't think anyone should be raised to be endlessly self-sacrificing. On the other hand, where they're crashing in to the culture in the same way girls were in 94, is they're crashing into that culture that tells them they should be beautiful, they should be sexy, they should be desirable, and they should mold their eyes to satisfy the male gaze. And that still is going on. And in fact, it's probably been heightened by social media use.
So many of our listeners are parents, but most of them probably have younger children than adolescents right now. I know we have a lot of listeners who have, say, you know, 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, that kind of thing. And I'm really curious, what would you tell a parent of a child that age who's trying to figure out how to help their kid, particularly if their kid's a girl, enter adolescence and thrive through adolescence?
Well, I would love to take this one because I'm a mother of a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. This is my reality every day right now. And I think there are a lot of things, and frankly, very simple things that parents can be doing right now. First of all, to speak to the pre-adolescent age children, this is a very good time to start conversations about technology and the online world and what is and isn't appropriate, what does and does not align with your family's values, with your family story. The biggest, most concrete recommendation that I want to make to parents is sit down and look at what your children are doing online. And in my case, what this means is that I have to sit next to my son and watch Minecraft tutorial videos. And they're soul-sucking. And there's a million other ways I'd like to spend my time. But here's why I think this is important. The Minecraft tutorial video may be totally innocuous. However, what video loads next automatically on YouTube? Or what are the videos that are showing up along the side? Or what advertisements pop up? And if kids are spending the kind of time online that research tells us they are, you know, 6 to 9 hours a day, depending on their age, if we really aren't dialed into how they're spending that time, we just can't support them. So if you have, and we know that boys tend to do more video gaming and listening to music and watching videos, whereas girls kind of gravitate more towards social media sites. So, you know, if you have a daughter, say, show me your Instagram feed. Show me who do you follow and why. What's an influencer? what influencers do you like? And how does TikTok work? Can you show me an example of something that you would send your friends in TikTok? Really get in there. It's going to be an awkward conversation initially. Your child may not be really excited about this. It just has to happen. Or we're really, really disconnected from how our children are spending their time online. But I think one of the things that we've really been saying is anything that we can do as families or parents that reflects what families have done across the span of time are things that are going to help children develop into healthy young adults. So spend time outdoors, go for family dog walks, invite neighbors over, read books aloud together, have, you know, I always like the Obama's Roses and Thorns report at the end of the day. At the meal, everyone shares their best moment and worst moment of the day. All of these things, again, it sounds very basic, but the ways that humans have interacted across millennia have been effective for a reason in raising competent, skilled, socially adept young adults.
Well, we are just about out of time. So before we let you go, we wanted to say thank you so much, both of you, for being on the show. And we're wondering, where can our listeners learn more about this new edition of Reviving Ophelia?
Both Mary Pfeiffer and I, Sarah Gilliam, have Facebook pages where we are sharing, you know, resources about the book and also kind of the articles and the research that we think are really helpful around this topic of adolescent girls. And then we both have websites as well, marypfeiffer.com and sarahgillamwrites.com.
Well, awesome. So Mary, Sarah, thank you so much for being on. And everybody go pick up the new edition of Reviving Ophelia. Okay, Cattell, it is time for my favorite part of the show, the fuck yeah of the week. Can you tell me what's making you say fuck yeah today?
Oh, I am going to say fuck yeah to the nap I took last week.
Tell me more.
So it was a weekend day. I didn't have a lot going on. I was just between like some tasks, like cleaning the house and going on an errand. And I was just sitting on the couch making a plan for my next move. And I was so tired. So I thought, let me just lie down, close my eyes. Like a nap seemed inevitable in that situation. But personally, just because that's not usually me, I didn't know what was going to happen.
Naps are very good. And I know that exact feeling where you're like, I just have to close my eyes for a sec. And I support it. I took one on the weekend too. I was actually watching Netflix during the day.
Ooh.
Which I never do. For me, that is very strange. Like I don't tend to turn on the television unless it's like after dinner time. And so even just sitting down and watching TV on a weekend is like kind of a weird treat. But I have been feeling like I needed to give myself more permission to just rest. And so not only was I on the couch watching TV, I then got snoozy feeling. And I just was like, you know what? I'm just going to let this happen. I will rewind this later.
I love that. That's so great. You know, I feel like I say I can't nap or I'm not good at napping. And what I'm realizing is mostly that's based in feelings of guilt and anxiety over not being productive every minute, which is not real. So like clearly I can nap and I did, and I'm going to try to do it way more often.
Yes, I think you deserve to do it more often, especially because you say you're not good at it. Well, there's only one way to get better. I prescribe naps.
Yeah, love it. Fuck yeah to naps.
Fuck yeah. That's it for us this week. Strong Feelings is recorded in Philadelphia and produced by Steph Colburn from Edit Audio. Our theme music is Deprogrammed by Philly's own Blow Dryer. Check them out at blowdryer.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Mary Pfeiffer and Sarah Pfeiffer Gilliam for being our guests today, and thank you for listening. If you liked our show, definitely subscribe and rate us wherever it is that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And make sure you get Strong Feelings in your inbox. Sign up for our newsletter at strongfeelings.co. See you again next week.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who I am.